here present with us this morning for the 6th annual Texas Alliance for Water Conservation Water College. We're glad all of you could make it and join us here for the many levels of expertise which will be presented here for you this morning and this afternoon. My name is Rudy Ritz from Texas Tech University. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Agricultural Education and Communications. I'm glad to be here with you this morning to introduce the following guest who will bring greetings on behalf of Texas Tech from the Department of Plant and Soil Science, Dr. Glenn Ritchie. Dr. Ritchie is the department chair and professor in plant and soil science at Texas Tech University. He's here to bring greetings to you this morning. Dr. Ritchie, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dr. Ritz, and thank you, everyone, for coming this morning. We're excited to have you here. This has been one of the truly enjoyable meetings that I have the opportunity to go to each year. You may wonder why I'm carrying a donut up here. I didn't get peckish. It's actually going to be an object lesson. But before I do that, I would like to quickly introduce a couple of people from our college. Dr. William F. Brown is the Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences and Natural Resources at Texas Tech, and Dr. Christy Bratcher is the Associate Dean, so thank you. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to speak, only to say that the TAWC to me is one of the real important and valuable institutions that are connected with the Department of Plant and Soil Sciences at Texas Tech. We've had the opportunity over the last year to introduce a water certificate program at Texas Tech University, and it's closely tied in with the mission and with the people at TAWC. I was thinking about it. We actually, for the fun of it, for one of my children's science fair project, we took a gallon container and we decided to catch the water while they were brushing their teeth and see how much water you use if you turn off the water while you're brushing your teeth versus if you turn on the water. And what we found was that we used about an extra 2 gallons of water every day if we didn't turn off the water brushing our teeth in our family, which, you know, that's significant, but I got figuring out we could save enough water by turning off the water brushing our teeth to be able to irrigate an acre of land, 1 inch of water, if we save that water for 35 years. And so I think it's important to realize when we're talking about acre inches, that's a quantity that's difficult for us to even wrap our minds around. Just to make this one donut is going to take us about 20 gallons of water. And the difference that's being made here through the TAWC and through the organizations that are working to improve our water efficiency is saving the equivalent of, you know, the entire water consumption of Dallas by what they do. And so the producers that are out there, if you're a producer, will you stand up for just a moment, please? You're the people on the front lines, and you're the people who have the boots on the ground and who are the difference makers for us. We appreciate the work that you do. We appreciate your support of Texas Tech, both the college and the Department of Plant and Soil Science. And I, as many of you are, looking forward to some great talks and some great presentations as we work to conserve water. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Ritchie. We really appreciate all of your support and your department's support as this project has moved through since its inception in 2005. Speaking of 2005, there would not be a TAWC without the support and the partnership from the Texas Water Development Board. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce your master of ceremonies for today's event, and that is Mr. Cameron Turner. Cameron Turner is the manager for agricultural water conservation programming at the Texas Water Development Board. And I also enjoy having Cameron come and working with us because he's one of our own. He grew up in Last Buddy, Texas. I'll let Cameron come up and tell his story to you on his own, but join me in welcoming Mr. Turner as our MC for today.
Good morning. Thanks for all of y'all taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. Master of Ceremonies sounds like a great title, but I think that just means I'm the low man on the totem pole that nobody else wants this gig. So I'll try to keep it short and brief. The bios for all the speakers are in your handouts, so I will try not to bore you with reading through each of those. There's a lot of great speakers that we have here, many that have traveled the world and have a lot of great experience to share with you today. And over my 13 years being at the Texas Water Development Board, I've had the good fortune of being able to work through this project and kind of translate some of the findings from this project and the success of this project onto other projects as well. So I think that's really a kind of a testament to the success of this project, is that there are other projects that have looked at copying this model or emulating this model in bringing together the industry folks, with all of our exhibitors out there. And, I encourage you during the breaks to take time to go visit with each of those exhibitors and learn about the tools and technologies and the information they have to share. But then there's also, the university side of things. And like Dr. Ritchie related there, it's important to kind of tie the research being done through this project and the findings back to the real world. It's hard to make that sell when we're just talking acre feet and acre inches. But whenever you can translate that into something that the general public can understand in terms of, the water we're saving translates to the water that the whole city of Dallas needs, I've seen that in some of our other projects where they've translated their savings to the amount of water that San Antonio needs. But I think it's more important to us also to translate the water savings into the water needs for the surrounding rural communities, because while it is a private property right and that groundwater is, each individual farmer's right to pump that, it's important that we're all taking that responsibility and conserving that water to help not only remain profitable within your organization, your operation, but also helping sustain those rural communities that we live in. And I'm going to jump into our schedule here. Like I said, we have a great lineup of speakers. Our first speaker is Mr. Kevin Brinkley, who is the CEO and president of Plains Cotton Cooperative. He's been working within the cotton industry for over 30 years. He's a graduate from Texas Tech, originally from Burnett, Texas. And I will welcome Mr. Brinkley up to the stage to take it over.
Cameron, thank you for that wonderful welcome here. Let me add my welcome, and thank you for coming out today on what I know is going to be a fantastic program. I was looking through the agenda this morning, and I can't wait to hear some of these topics myself. Now, Glenn, I was listening to your comments on the importance of water, and I think as we look over about the next half hour at what's happening in the world in terms of what population is doing, you're really going to get a sense of how important water is and is going to become. And I believe it will be the number one driver of decision-making for agriculture in the future. What I would like to do is just take a few minutes, and we're going to explore some topics that probably are not something you think about every day, but they do serve as an important backdrop for all the things that we do in agriculture, and especially those of you in the room that produce food and fiber. This is going to be one of those things that kind of gives you a direction for the future. And we'll talk about what that means in terms of not only production, but what it means to us economically. So what I'd like to do is just kind of talk about, for a second, the setting that we're in right now in terms of history. And this is a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer this out loud. But currently, do you think this is the darkest time in the history of the world? And just that's just kind of a true or false answer. You've got a lot of news hitting you every day. We're going to talk about some of that as we go forward. Another question that I would like to pose to this group is, what percent of the world do you think lives in poverty? And I hope they're not taking my screen all the way. There you go. Thank you. So I've given you four choices here, and I just kind of want you to make a mental note of what you choose here. We're going to give the answer a little bit later in this presentation. But again, you have a lot of news hitting you every day. Do you think, what do you think is the poverty rate? And I've given you a number of 61 at the top percentage there down to 28% to choose from. So just kind of make a mental note of that, and we'll come back to talk about that one later on. So for most of the world's population, the human condition actually has improved. And we could look back at some periods in time that seem pretty dark compared to where they are now. And I think that we'll agree that most of what we're seeing in today's news flow is probably not as bad as some of the things that have happened to us in the future. But what does that mean for us here in the ag community? Well, our population is going to shift. So we're going to talk about the next 80 years. I'm going to limit my time here. I'm not sure I'll get to that next 80 years. But we're going to talk about the trends and where that's pointing us. I've got a map up on the screen right now. And so what I need for you to do is kind of look at it and just in general terms. Don't try to focus on any one country. But I want you to try to look at the whole map as I hit this button. And you're going to see some changes. The shading on these colors, these countries in the map, is going to become darker as their population becomes higher. And I'll give you a hint, kind of look at the middle of the map. Okay, so we're all the way out to the year 2100. The big change that you notice on that map is that Africa has become very populated in the next 80 years. And so what I'd like to do is kind of look at that in comparison to some of the other areas around the world that we typically think of as the most populous places on the planet, because currently they are. And that would be China and India. So we'll take a look at China's population trend here to begin with. And you notice that their population is still growing, not at the same rate that it was over the past few years, but it is still on the uptrend. But you're going to notice that around the year 2020 or so, the population in China is going to begin to peak, and then it's going to begin to decline. There are a number of reasons for this. This is a natural phenomenon as countries begin to develop economically. And then in China, I think probably most people in this room are aware that China has had a growth control policy. They've had basically a restriction of one child per family. That's been lifted because they see this trend coming. But it is important because they are missing basically 2 to 3 generations of people that normally would be contributing to the population. So let's look at the next place on the planet that I think most of us think is a pretty populated country, and that's India. India, you notice, has a similar pattern to China. The population there is going to continue to grow, and it'll start to peak out somewhere in that 2060 range. The peak will begin to develop. And again, as countries develop economically, typically their population does not grow at the same rate that it has in the past. So I want you to keep a close eye on the screen here. The next one I'm going to put up is just the continent of Africa. So by the year 2100, the entire continent of Africa will have about 4.5 billion people. So let's talk about the reasons behind that growth, because it is astounding. When you look at that compared to China and India, that is astounding growth. So if you look at developed countries around the world, we'll just take the U.S. here at home. Our growth rate, our population growth rate here, or if you just want to call it the birth rate, is about 1.88. And so that means that each woman that has children has 1.88 children on average. And if you combine that with a male and female that it takes to accomplish that task, 1.88 is not quite replacement rate for our population. So that it takes about 2.1 births per female to make that work because of certain mortality rates. If you look at China, their number has moved up to about 1.68. For reference, Russia is about 1.75. The European countries are somewhere in that 1.5 to 1.75 rate. And if you look at a country like Mexico, it's about 2.1 replacement rate. Latin American countries, roughly the same. So if I were to ask you, what do you think it is in Africa? I'm not sure what kind of answers we would get here. Maybe we'll just take a stab at that. Anybody want to take the most fertile country in Africa? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Five. You're very close. That's about the average in Africa. Nigeria, the average woman there has seven children, actually a little over seven children on average for that country. There are a number of reasons for the high birth rate there in Africa. Marriage is near universal for their population. They begin to have children at a very early age, so there's a long window of reproduction in those countries. And generally, the contraception is not a major practice over there, so you see this very high birth rate that takes place. And this, because of these factors, this is what the trends are telling us. If you were to look at the birth rates of all the countries on the planet and rank those in terms of the highest birth rate to the lowest, you would have to go to country number 27 not to find a country in Africa. So if you want to think back to that map and that population projection line from the United Nations, there's a very distinct reason why you see Africa will be the population center of the planet 80 years from now if these trends hold. So if we look at some places that have been in the news a lot lately, China is certainly one of those. We've been in a trade war with them for a little over a year and a half to 2 years. And China, we began to pick up some news about them that maybe their economy is not exactly where they would like it to be. They report these very high growth rates, but they've got some headwinds that are due to population that are going to be facing them. So if we look at, again, this is sort of the front half of that Chinese population curve that we looked at earlier. And you see that they're going to have a little over 1.4 billion people here, and then again, it starts to recede. But they've got another problem that's coming down to what is the age of that population. Remember, they had a one-child policy for several years, and this is what's resulting. People are living longer, and because they're missing a lot of younger generations, the percentage of their population that is actually going to be over the age of 65 is growing dramatically. And we know from our experience here in the U.S. and other developed countries that this begins to be an enormous question for the cost of maintaining that population to society. And in some cases, this can actually become a drag. So what does this mean to agriculture? Well, we're interested in, as producers of agricultural products, the most productive country on earth in agricultural products, we're interested in what can we do not only to feed and clothe our own population, But what can we do to meet the needs of those around the world and hopefully make it benefit our businesses here as American farmers? Every country in the world has a gap between what it produces and what it consumes. And so we produce much more than we consume. That makes us a net exporter of all agricultural products. But there are a lot of countries around the world, some of those we've talked about already in terms of population growth, that do not produce enough to meet their consumption targets. So we're going to look at a couple of very important ones here for just a few minutes. I want you to look at this map before we do that. This is basically what you see in terms of the populations of each of these continents. And you can tell, again, this is a snapshot of where we stand today. 1.4 billion people in China, about the same number of people in India. Southeast Asia is very populated. When you take all of their countries together, it's very populated. And then you look at the U.S., 366 million people when you combine us with Canada and Mexico, and Europe and South America, both not quite at three-quarters of a billion people. But let's look at what it takes when you put the GDP of these areas next to their population. So you can see that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico still has the largest economy on Earth. That's why we enjoy the standard of living that we do, is because our GDP compared to our population is so high. And then you look at China is the next biggest economy on the planet, $15 trillion that the Chinese have, but it's spread over many more people than what we have here. And most economists will tell you that China, just because of the sheer number of people that it has and the fact that they are becoming more productive, their economy probably in the next 10 to 15 years will probably get bigger than we have here in North America. But you can see here that that there's going to be this balancing act that the world plays in terms of population versus what the size of the economy is. So I asked you earlier what percentage of the world you think lives in poverty. And so we may have had some people that chose A. That is actually not the right answer. 61% is wrong. 54% might seem like, if you look at the news, that might seem like an adequate answer for this, but that one is also wrong. 35%, a third, that doesn't, just over a third, doesn't sound too bad. That one is actually wrong. And so that only leaves D, right? It's also wrong. The actual answer to this is 10.6% of the world lives in poverty. And I know when I first took a look at that number, I was absolutely shocked by it. So let's unpack that and see what it means. So according to the folks at the UN and the World Bank that study this, about $1.90 a day is, if you're below that line, that indicates that you're in poverty. And that money makes no sense to us. We spend that on a cup of coffee here in the U.S. But if you were in one of these lesser developed countries, it is an actually significant number that we see. So if you look at the trend over time, I'm just going to look at this from 1981 down to the projections of what we might see in the year 2030. And you can see here that we're going to go below, if these projections hold true, we will be less than 5% of the global population will be underneath that poverty line. And almost 80% of those individuals live in rural areas and rely on farming for a living. So this is actually good news, that's a little bit hard to find these days, but this is something that I think we need to be aware of, because less people in poverty is good on several levels, not the least of which means that it's an opportunity for us to produce products that they need. So this is how that's come about. The chart, the histogram, the distribution on the left is a 1970 snapshot of the amount of the world that lived in poverty. Between those two distributions is a global map. And you can see, if you look at 1970, much of the world live beneath the poverty line, and that pink distribution was basically the whole of Asia was living in poverty at that time. Fast forward to 2018, the last time this data was collected on a global basis, and you can see that almost all of Asia is out of poverty. And there's a reason for that that we're going to talk about here as we move forward. The other thing that I'll point out, you can look at the U.S. and, or say North America and Europe, those yellow and green shadings up there. We've not seen that much poverty the historically, at least in the last 100 years. So as you look at those numbers, those distributions have not changed all that much. The one that has remained about the same is Africa. It's about half in, half out, so to speak. You'll just notice that the blue area is bigger because you have more people living there, as we've discussed. So if we look at Africa here, corn, an important food product that we produce here in the U.S. and in Texas, we notice that as they look for corn, they consume far more than they produce. In fact, they have not met their own needs, as you look, since back in the 1970s when their population was a lot lower. If you think about the population trends that we've discussed, this number is going to get a lot bigger over time. And just for reference, I've penciled in what we produce here in the U.S., 369 million metric tons on average. So we could more than meet the needs, for at least for the next few years, with corn production here in the U.S. Wheat is an even more pronounced story here. Again, we produce about 54 million metric tons of wheat here in the U.S., and we couldn't send it all to Africa, obviously, but there's going to be a need for wheat production to feed that population on that continent. Cotton happens to be one of the things that they can produce there. A lot of their land falls into the arid and semi-arid category, and cotton is one of the things that they can do in surplus. Now, a lot of that is due to the fact that there is no real textile manufacturing on that continent. So everything they produce pretty much is a surplus. But you can see, even with everything that they've got here, around 6 to 7 million bales of cotton is as much as they can produce to compete on the world market. Let's talk about China for a second. We know that we have relied on China as a very significant market for U.S. cotton growers to export to. So if we look at what China's done here, very few times in their history, that, or at least what's on this slide, have they produced more than what they've used. We at our office do not believe that this picture is going to change very much, and if anything, that gap may grow. China is diverting more and more of its arable land to the production of food, but they are the world's largest consumer of cotton. So this picture is probably going to become more pronounced over time. But given the backdrop of the discussions about trade with China, this is an important one for us to look at, as is soybean production. And you can see here that the gap between what they produce in terms of soybeans and what they actually use is very pronounced here. We're down to, you know, them using probably, not in the too distant future, 100 million metric tons more than what they produce. This has taken a little bit of a pause as of recent, and I think most of the folks in this room have probably heard of African swine fever that has dented their pork herd probably by anywhere from 25 to 35%. Their pork production has been reported recently down 31%. So they use a lot of soybeans to make that happen. So this is going to be on pause for just a few minutes. But as soon as they ramp that herd back up, we expect this growth is going to continue. And that's why you saw such emphasis placed on soybeans during the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China. But the two folks that can supply that pretty much are the Brazilians and U.S., both producing about the same, about 110 to 115 million metric tons on average. So when you look at that soybean demand chart, there are some countries that clearly benefited from that. China wasn't able to do much of anything. They're at the bottom of this chart. Their production of soybeans has been fairly flat. They're not all that productive on any crop, but certainly not on soybeans. The Argentines got in on the action here. They've been able to ramp up their sales of soybeans into China, and we have. I mean, this is there is no doubt that the American soybean farmer benefited from China's consumption of soybeans. And maybe we had just a little bit too much concentrated risk in our soybean production with China, because when the trade negotiations fell apart, the soybean trade did as well. But the overwhelming winner of this was Brazil. Brazil has absolutely made a fortune off of trading soybeans to China. So how are they able to do this? Well, one of the things they've done is they've broken out a lot of land. And this is a very controversial topic because of the nature of Brazil's land. You know, you hear a lot of things in the news about the Amazon and the rainforest and their importance to the world ecosystem. But they have broken out a whole lot of land. This is not a cumulative chart. This is how much they break out every year. And although the growth rate slowed for a little bit there around 2012, you can see that it's slowly ticking back up. We don't see, short of something from a policy perspective in Brazil, why this will stop. So they're going to continue to break out land, and they're going to continue to compete with the U.S., not only on soybeans, but as most of you know, they're fierce competitors in the cotton market. So who are the competitors of the future? Brazil obviously has broken out a lot of land. Again, their growth rate of what they put into production continues to rise. Argentina, for a while, was completely flat. Then they expanded their agricultural production for a while, but they've plateaued out again. I'm going to add China to the list. You can see here that they have tried everything they can to move up in recent years without any success. And this chart basically just represents what percent of the land in that country is devoted to agriculture. India. We talked about the population of India growing, but they are not a productive country at present when it comes to any of their crops. And I'm going to add in the U.S. here. This is one of the things. This might not, well, let me hit the next button there. But the U.S., we actually use less land to produce than we used to. This is not a bad sign. This, in many ways, indicates that we've become much more productive on the land that we do have devoted to agriculture. And I think this is one of the sustainability issues that we're going to face going down the road, is how to be more productive on less land, or at least produce more on the same amount of land as we go forward. And Africa, we can see here, they have added about a little over 5% to their land in production. That number for them probably is going to necessarily have to grow some way, somehow. But that is a very unanswered question. So if we look at lesser developed countries, these are the ones that are going to be very high on the population growth charts. What do they need? Well, what every country needs, they need money to develop not only their industry but their agriculture. They need infrastructure. Many of these countries are lacking basic roads, ports. We're going to talk about some of that as we go forward. Education. Lesser developed countries are less likely to have advanced education systems that make them more productive. They need time to accomplish this. And then basically they need some political stability. Again, no shortage of news on that topic. So let's talk about electricity for a second. If you look at the world average here, about 90% of the world has some form of reliable access to electricity. And we're just going to continue to pick on Africa here for just a second because of that population projection. Right now, if you look at Africa, less than 50% of that country has reliable power supply. So if you look at the needs for development, certainly there's a basic need here that's lacking to develop out infrastructure and industry. Quality of their ports. So if you're going to trade agricultural products or anything else for that matter, you need good a good ability to get those products in and out of the country. The World Bank has a survey of exporting companies around the world, and they asked them to rate the quality of port infrastructure for various continents. You can see that the U.S. ranks highest on that. That's probably not a surprise when you look at the amount of trade that we do in this country. China's ports are actually quite good. They have 16 major port cities. Some of those are quite robust, and we'll look at some of their numbers here shortly. But if you look at Africa and Brazil, they're still lacking in basic infrastructure around ports. And Brazil's ability to catch up on this is probably going to be one of the choke points for them developing their trade. Workforce skills, only about 68% of the sub-Saharan Africans have the equivalent of a high school education. So their education is woefully underdeveloped at this point, but we suspect that that will have to improve for their continent to improve. I asked you this question earlier. I think obviously the answer to this is false. We are actually experiencing, contrary to what you might hear in the constant news barrage that we get, things have improved dramatically over the past several decades, and we expect this improvement to continue for the next several years. And I think part of it is if you look at what you're hit with every day in terms of, you know, the news channels that we watch, stuff constantly coming in on your phone, it is hard really to isolate that and say, okay, what's really happening? And that's why we all need to use the blessing of a brain to think about and research what's actually happening in the world versus just taking the constant bad news message that's out there. So what does this mean for our farmers? Well, we need to talk about this because trade is the thing that drives our industry. One of the things we looked at in the backdrop of the trade dispute that we had with China was what happened in 1980 when we stopped trading wheat with Russia because of some geopolitical disputes that we had with them. And so you can see that vertical line there. 1980 is when the embargo was placed onto trade of wheat with Russia. And you can see that the Russians, basically their production bounced around there for a few years. And then starting in the mid-2000s, they begin to crack the code on producing wheat in the former USSR. And so they did eventually learn how to do this, but the important part of this is what happened to trade. And so we can see that there was a little bit of trade as that embargo kicked in. If you go back and look at some of the writings about what happened during that grain embargo, there was probably actually a lot of U.S. wheat that did end up in Russia. It probably made a stop somewhere else first. Or maybe it was sent, the U.S. wheat was sent to Argentina and they just sold theirs at an arbitrage to the Russians for a much higher price. But eventually, our trade of wheat stopped with Russia. You can see that we flatline on the bottom down there because they have basically become self-sufficient in that and in some cases an export competitor. So this is what trade policy does. It changes the flow of where trade goes, and we're going to look at some of that in context of what we're going through right now. One thing that we do know, and this is good news because of the agreement that was signed on January 15th, the Phase One trade deal with China, is we know that free trade works for agriculture. So I have on the screen here a list of all of the countries that we've had an agreement with since about the mid-1990s. And you can look, the red bars, that's the amount of average trade that we had with those countries in the 5 years preceding a trade agreement. The gold bars is what happened to trade in the 5 years immediately after the trade agreement is signed. So in every case, trade always expands after a free trade agreement. So we can take some optimism here that a phase one deal with China is hopefully going to follow this same pattern and begin to expand our agricultural exports again. And you know best of all that that's what we need to improve pricing of all of our commodities, especially the ones that we produce here on the Texas High Plains. Just a little example about what happens when countries do engage in free trade. This is from around the 2000 mark. And you see on the top of that, India, this is what happened to their trade since that time. India has been more or less an isolationist country when it comes to trade. They have a lot of tariffs. They have a lot of protection on what gets traded and what can be traded into India. China, on the other hand, for all their characteristics, we'll call it, they joined the WTO right around 2000, and you can see that their trade, this is a deficit for them. I mean, they're bringing in a whole lot of products here, but this is what happened to their trade over time. So again, free trade greatly expands what a country does in terms of economic activity. China still is very dominant when it comes to cotton, a product that I know is important to most of the folks in this room. They produce somewhere around 20 to 22% of the world crop in cotton. They also use about a third of the world's cotton. And they're also hugely dominant in when it comes to trade and when it comes to how much cotton is in ending stocks. One of the things that we have to keep in mind as we, again, think about our trading relationships with those around the world is what do we have in terms of concentrated risk? So these are supposed to be little cotton bales on screen here. There are 100 of those. And each one of those colors corresponds to the country that we have a trading relationship with. And so if you just look at what it takes to keep our industry going in cotton, if you cannot trade with China, you begin to take away market share. You can see that the opportunities are harmed pretty seriously there. Mexico is another one that we have a tenuous relationship with. It's gotten better as of late, and we hope that continues. But again, an important customer for U.S. cotton. If you look at Turkey, man, I tell you, it's our expectation that the news out of Turkey is going to degrade this year. We think that the political climate there and the economic climate is probably going to be very, very challenging globally, and that may impact our ability to trade with what's historically been a very good customer for U.S. cotton. But again, if we were to get into a trade spat with the India, and you get the idea here, we have a lot of concentrated risk in very few countries, and this is why our trading relationships with them are so important and why we spend so much time on trade policy. Another, we think, positive thing is going to be people are moving into the middle class globally. These bars are representing, again, what we think of in terms of the population that lives in poverty, and I've penciled in some notes underneath here. We're going to have 150 million people move out of the poor category into one of the better classes of purchasing power. And so this is going to, we believe, again, help the consumption of products globally and bring additional trade. One of the things that we look at in terms of where can we sell cotton is where are the biggest markets for this, what's happening in terms of consumer trends. I have a map here on the left that shows what we traditionally would expect to trade with each one of these countries. $1.6 billion with India, $19.6 billion. If you've looked at what is coming out of the news that's coming out of the Phase One agreement, that number is going to be double in China, and possibly more than that, at least for the next 2 years. So that could be very good news. And again, you see here sort of the market share that we have in these countries, along with the dollar volume of trade that we have with them. But I think perhaps the best news out of all of this is that in China, you're going to have 151 million new households in the middle class by the year 2025. Think about the purchasing power, 151 million new households. And again, similar story in India and in Indonesia. So there is reason for hope out there as we look toward the future. In terms of economic cycles, the U.S. Here where we live is sort of in late-term expansion. That does not mean that a recession is around the corner. That just means that we have been in an expansionary period for 11 years now, and that will, at some point, we'll go into a contraction period. Hopefully it won't be very serious, but the one that you notice down there is China. And at first you might think, well, China says they're growing at 6% annual GDP growth. Why would they be in a recession? And first of all, you need to be careful about what the Chinese government says about what's actually happening in their economy. But we know that when credit becomes an issue in any country around the world, that's typically when things indicate that you're in a recession. And we certainly know that credit access in China is starting to become a real problem. Credit service is a real problem, along with building inventories. And this was all accelerated by their issues with trade. So we've got the population growth that's going to drive demand, income improvements, production capacity in countries like ours is going to help demand. And we do know that on the supply side that we've got some, at least temporarily, we've got some positive developments on the trade front. So you might say, well, Kevin, that all sounds good, but that sounds a long way out. What am I supposed to do until all that stuff kicks in? This is a real question for our producers, because we have had some pretty tough years here the last couple of years. Well, there are some things that, and that's why I'm so excited about what's happening at this conference and others. There are some things that that our producers are really looking hard at right now. This is the unfortunate picture that we see in U.S. agriculture right now. Working capital has been, we're just about down to the bone on working capital for American farmers right now. This has got to be rebuilt. And this means that we need some positive developments in markets. We need prices to strengthen. And we need to get our farmers strongly back on their feet where they can compete in these markets. But there are opportunities for change. I've got a shaded area here on screen that here in West Texas, just in Texas cotton production area, represents basically the range of production costs, whether you're irrigated. That's why I've left it as a range, anywhere from, you know, the low 60s to the low 80s in terms of what it costs to produce a pound of cotton. And you can see here the average price for seed, that blue line, in many cases does not cover the cost. And so what we've got to do is we've got to focus on things that improve this. There are really three ways to get at this. One is that, and this is what you're doing today, you're focusing how can I get the most for what I'm spending in inputs, and focusing on how are there areas that I can bring down the cost of what it takes to grow a bale of cotton or a bushel of corn or milo or wheat, whatever it is. Secondly, we've got to become a whole lot more innovative when it comes to marketing. And that's what companies like ours are charged with, and we're looking at this every day. How can we add value to the product that our producers are making every day? And then this takes all of us advocating for strong federal farm safety nets to help us navigate these rough waters, help us make it through to when we can get back on our feet again, and we don't need this. So this is something I really urge you to be involved in. Get involved with your trade associations, donate, even if it's a little bit, to their political action committees, because people like Plains Cotton Growers, the National Cotton Council, and others are doing great work trying to give us safety nets. I'd like to thank the folks that put this data together for me, and I think that will conclude my remarks here, unless somebody has a question for me. All right. Thank you very much.